Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 6th. I'm your reader. Now let's get started with some local news from Fort Dodge. And our first Fort Dodge headline today reads, Busy General Election for Council School Board is Tuesday. Some very full ballots await Fort Dodge voters in Tuesday's general election. In the general election, voters will pick 5 members of the City Council and 5 members of the Fort Dodge Community School District Board of Education. Additionally, they will vote on a referendum question asking if the Webster County government should be allowed to borrow $45.5 million to pay for constructing a new jail. The polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday. A list and map of polling places will be published in Tuesday's edition of The Messenger. In the City Council election, the candidates for the at-large seat are Eugene Newsom and Councilwoman Megan Secor. The candidates for the ward seats are Jen Crimmins and Scott Davis in Ward 1, Shannon Krause and Councilman Cameron Nelson in Ward 2, Councilman Dave Flattery in Ward 3, and Councilman Kim Allstott in Ward 4. For the school board, 8 candidates are running for 4 seats, and the winners will serve 4-year terms. Running for those seats are incumbents Bill Kent and Diane Pratt, plus Emily Denklau, Brian Pedersen, Allison Roderick, Sarah Sankey, Keenan Shure, and Terry Townsend. Dan Altman is running unopposed to complete an unexpired term he was appointed to complete in March of 2022. The bond issue must be approved by 60% of those voting in order to pass. Our next local story has a headline that reads, VFW helps family with flag. A handful of khaki-clad members of Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 1856 crisply saluted recently as a new American flag was raised. Veterans saluting during a flag-raising ceremony is a common sight. But the location of Friday's salute was a little different. It took place in the front yard of the home of Don and Joan Ports at 1636 10th Avenue North, after the veterans fixed the flagpole and presented the couple with a new flag. Flying the flag is really important to the Ports family, according to Joan Ports. We live in the best country in the world, she said. Patriotism has nothing to do with politics. The family also has a history of serving the country in the military. Don Ports is a veteran of the Iowa Army National Guard, where he served in an infantry unit. Joan Ports' father served in the Korean War, and her son was a submarine sailor in the Navy. The family has had a flagpole in the front yard for a while, but recently the pole and the flag were showing signs of wear and tear. The flag had slid down and could no longer reach the top of the pole. Joan Ports said the flag was, quote, crunched up and had been torn in a storm. She said that George Sexton, a Marine Corps veteran who is the commander of the local VFW post, stopped by the house and offered to help them get their flag up properly. They were striving to get our American colors up, Sexton said. Sexton said he would bring them a new flag. That new flag was the one the VFW Color Guard raised Friday afternoon. Sexton said the VFW will assist any local resident who needs help with their flag or flag pole. And now turning to some business briefs for Fort Dodge. This headline reads, Lamoureux joins Friendship Haven team as ground supervisor. Friendship Haven has announced that Rick Lamoureux has joined the team as a ground supervisor. In his role, he will oversee, coordinate, and manage the full ground staff to help maintain a clean, neat, and safe environment. Lamoureux attended Northwest Missouri State University in Maryville, Missouri, where he graduated with a degree in Parks and Recreational Management. He has spent the better part of the last 20 years managing garden centers and currently serves on the Fort Dodge Community Schools Foundation Board and is a member of the Fort Dodge Noon Saratoma. He lives in Fort Dodge with his wife, Megan, and their 5 children. And continuing with business briefs, we have some other Friendship Haven news. This headline reads, Friendship Haven announces new board members. Friendship Haven has announced 3 new members of its board of directors. Lindsay Hefferman, director of Iowa Central Community College's Radiologic Technologist Program. Linda Whaley, former vice president of clinical services at Unity Point Health. And the Reverend Jenna Finch Manchester have been named to the board. Heffernan has been the director of Iowa Central Community College's Radiologic Technologist Program since 2017. She grew up in Northeast Iowa and enjoys spending time being active with her husband and their 4 children. She's an Iowa Central alum who continued her education at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in diagnostic medical sonography, and finally completed her Master of Business Administration with an emphasis in healthcare management from North Central University. She has worked in many facets of healthcare, including women's health and high-risk obstetrics. Whaley graduated from Iowa Methodist School of Nursing as a registered nurse, and later completed her bachelor's and master's degrees in healthcare administration. During her 40-plus year career at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center, she worked in the intensive care unit and managed several departments, including cardiology, where she was instrumental in getting the expanded cardiology services, including the addition of a cardiac cath lab. The last 18 years at Unity Point Health, she was vice president of clinical services and later also led the patient experience initiative. Since retirement, some of her activities include leadership team consulting, volunteering at TRMC, and helping the Webster County Health Department with vaccination clinics. Finch Manchester moved to Fort Dodge in June 2020 to serve as Trinity United Methodist Church pastor. Since being in Fort Dodge, she has participated in the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance Leadership Program, served on the Brady O'Brien Board as spiritual director, mentored other United Methodist Church pastors, and worked to find transportation for English language learner students. And our next local story has a headline that reads, In His Footsteps, Vietnam Veteran Served in Her Father's Wake. And editor's note, this is an article that first appeared on November 1st, 2020. Though she wouldn't describe herself as being part of, quote, the action during the Vietnam War, the layman might not have known it watching Barb Bianchi control air traffic in the U.S. Air Force. My job was just to get them in and out, said Bianchi, who was a sergeant in Guam and Turkey, in addition to Texas and South Dakota, from 1974 to 1983. We had B-52s coming in and out, she said. Being an air traffic controller is always a matter of having your mind going in 15 different directions at the same time, she said. That can be particularly true with small runways on islands like Guam, where the strip was only 3 miles long and 1 mile wide. When those planes came in, we usually had our hands on the red crash phone, Bianchi said. Those B-52s would take the entire runway. It was always like we were white-knuckling it, she said. Please lift off, "Don't go in the water," she would repeat in Guam, directing traffic that she had to keep separate from parallel civilian traffic. In Turkey, she wore a helmet and canteen belt as the country was briefly at war with Greece. There, she had to decipher what the Turkish air traffic controllers were doing to keep their traffic and U.S. military traffic separated by gestures, not language. But no matter where she was or what she was doing, being usually the only woman in the room meant she had to do things differently. "It's a man's world," she said. "I think I was accepted because I studied so hard. If I wouldn't have done that, they wouldn't have respected me at all." Over her 9 years of service, she was a crew chief on every base, but her first one for training, where she earned respect by maintaining outstanding performance, a requirement that might not have been necessary for respect had she been a man. "I did it because I loved it," she said, but not because she thought she had to be better than them. "I just had to be better than myself every day," Bianchi said, something she tells her grandchildren. "Your only goal today is to be better than you were yesterday." Though she didn't ask to be put into air traffic control, she absolutely loved it, working both control towers and radar towers. Bianchi's inspiration to go into the service came from her adoptive father, Gerald Vandeval, who took her in at age 12 after her only living parent died. His service was just exemplary. He displayed so much integrity, honesty, Bianchi said. "He was truly my hero and my example." Watching him iron his uniforms to a paper-thin crease, she came to learn that when worn, the uniforms were more than a shirt and pair of pants, greater than the sum of their parts as they covered the patriots who defended their country. She set out to emulate him, and in doing so, left a proud example. In her service, Bianchi earned a Meritorious Service Medal and 2 Commendation Medals for, quote, immeasurable contributions to her squadron and tours of duty that were, quote, exemplary and mirror the image of the ideal Air Force non-commissioned officer, according to her commander, Lieutenant Colonel Ronald L. Davidson. During her time, she developed realistic training simulators with mock situation scenarios, helped needy military families through Operation Warm Heart, saved landing planes from crashing without their wheels down, and contributed her photographic memory to the benefit of her peers. On Veterans Day, she remembers that the price of freedom is high, even to the many veterans who return alive. "The price of freedom is the highest price, in my opinion, paid," she said. And normally at this time, we would turn to Fort Dodge obituaries, but there are no new obituaries for today, so we will continue with the news. And continuing with local news headlines, we have this one that reads, Uber for EMS. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg promotes Iowa United First Aid. The dateline is Rockwell City. When the unthinkable happens, whether that's a car crash, a farm accident, or a heart attack, minutes count. But what if an ambulance crew can't get there fast enough? If there's an emergency, there's an expectation that help is coming quickly, said Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, who spoke at the Rockwell City Public Library on Thursday. Rural EMS can be a challenge, however. Average ambulance response time is 25 to 30 minutes in some areas. As this challenge becomes more widespread in rural Iowa, Gregg is promoting Iowa United First Aid and seeking volunteers for this innovative program. Calhoun County is one of 3 counties, along with Cass County in southwest Iowa and Van Buren County in southeast Iowa, to participate in a pilot program for Iowa United First Aid. The mission is to provide immediate medical intervention during the critical window between the onset of an emergency and the arrival of traditional ambulance assistance. Volunteers who sign up to be part of Iowa United First Aid will receive approximately 10 hours of CPR plus level training for free. The training will cover CPR, first aid, control the bleed, and use of an automated external defibrillator, or AED, a sophisticated yet easy-to-use medical device that helps to reestablish an effective heart rhythm in people experiencing sudden cardiac arrest. Along with those trained volunteers, Iowa United First Aid will leverage GPS location technology and smartphones to promote faster response time. The system is like Uber, but for life-saving, Greg said, using technology to notify the trained first aid volunteers who are closest to the site of the emergency could really be a game changer for rural Iowa, he said. Each county in the pilot project for Iowa United First Aid is receiving $75,000, including $50,000 in state funds, plus a $25,000 match from the county to fund the program for a year. Trained first aid volunteers will receive a go bag containing basic first aid gear and an AED valued at approximately $2,500 to use in their role with Iowa United First Aid. Volunteers are not expected to be on call constantly. They can decline a request for assistance if they are unavailable. In that case, dispatch will reach out to other volunteers in the region. Dispatch won't send an alert to every volunteer for every emergency, said Greg, who noted that Iowa's Good Samaritan law protects first aid volunteers in terms of liability. Also, volunteers won't be sent to every emergency, such as a domestic violence case or hazmat situation. While Iowa United First does not replace the need for EMTs, paramedics, or ambulance service, trained volunteers can bridge the gap between an emergency and the time when the ambulance arrives. Early activation of 911, along with immediate CPR and first aid, can double or triple a person's chance of survival, according to information shared with the 20 people who attended the Thursday meeting in Rockwell City. Also, research has shown that the sooner CPR is started after cardiac arrest, the better the outcomes, Greg added. Every minute that passes without CPR reduces the likelihood of survival by approximately 7% to 10%, according to CPR Select. Both Greg, who grew up in Hawarden, and Governor Kim Reynolds, who grew up in St. Charles, are strong proponents of Iowa United First Aid. We both come from small towns, and it's really important to us that there's a good quality of life in small town Iowa, Greg said. The idea for Iowa United First Aid took root during a trade mission to Israel in March of 2022. That's where Greg learned about United Hatzalah, a free volunteer-based emergency medical services organization that serves people throughout Israel. Hatzalah is the Hebrew word for rescue, said Greg, who noted that the Israeli volunteers' average response time is 90 seconds in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and 3 minutes in other parts of Israel. Greg met with Eli Beer, the founder of United Hatzalah. Beer had always wanted to work on an ambulance crew and achieved his goal while he was still a teenager. Through his years of service, however, he learned that ambulances rarely, if ever, arrive fast enough to save a life. He never forgot the time a call came in to assist a 7-year-old girl who choked on food during a birthday party. By the time the ambulance arrived, 45 minutes later, the girl had died, Greg said. A doctor who lived right around the corner said, "If only I had known, I could have saved her." This story not only motivated Beer to create United Hatzalah, but it touched Greg as well. I was incredibly inspired by the work United Hatzalah does and wondered if this is something we could adapt for rural Iowa, Greg said. we have a lot in common with Israel, including an ethic of respecting and protecting God-given life. The need is great, he added. There are lots of situations where minutes matter, where someone is bleeding from a farm accident, suffering a heart attack or stroke, or facing an opioid overdose. These things happen every day throughout our state, he said. Along with training in basic first aid, CPR, and operating an AED, first aid volunteers can also be trained to handle Narcan, an opioid overdose treatment. We're not asking for EMT-level training for Iowa United First Aid, Greg said. The only requirement, once volunteers are trained, is to keep current on their CPR certification every 2 years. The minimum age to participate in Iowa United First Aid is 18. Project leaders hope to get 25 to 30 volunteers who are strategically located throughout each county to participate in the pilot program. Van Buren County has 30 volunteers signed up already. Calhoun County has approximately 8 so far, although more people expressed an interest following the recent meeting in Rockwell City. Rural Iowa is known for its tight-knit communities, where people work together to solve challenges, said Scott Jacobs, a Calhoun County supervisor, who looks forward to seeing Iowa United First Aid get underway. Iowa United First Aid also creates a unique opportunity for people interested in a medical career, Greg noted. I think this will be a workforce pipeline for future EMTs and paramedics who will go on to serve with ambulance crews in our communities, he said. He's optimistic that Iowa United First Aid can expand beyond the 3 counties in the pilot program. There's no reason this concept has to be limited to just a few counties or just rural counties, he said. It could work in Des Moines and other cities, too. And now turning to some local sports news. This headline reads, Tritons are regional champs. Iowa Central lands national volleyball bid again. Sturgis is tourney MVP. The dateline is Boone. Sarah Horn said goodbye to a generational sophomore class last season at Iowa Central. The veteran volleyball coach had a feeling her returning Triton players, along with a strong influx of recruits, could help bridge the gap in 2023. Iowa Central didn't just shore up any lingering deficiencies, though. Horn's squad has built a legacy all their own. The 9th-ranked Tritons captured a 4th consecutive Region 11 tournament championship here Sunday, outlasting number 11 DMAC on the Bears' home court with a thrilling 5-set victory. Scores were 28-30, 25-17, 25-8, 22-25, and 15-5 in favor of Iowa Central, which clinched the region's only automatic bid to the NJCAA Division II National Tournament. DMAC and 4th-rated Kirkwood, the team the Tritons, who are 31-5 overall, defeated in Saturday semifinals, now must wait to see if they receive at-large invitations. Horn predicted her group would have very little margin for error in this year's regional bracket. Iowa Central shared the regular season title, its 6th in a row, with both the Bears and the Eagles. We knew it would be even harder to qualify this time around, but I don't think we could have imagined the route that we drew, having to face Hawkeye in the quarters, Kirkwood in the semis, and DMAC in the finals, Horn said. Our team is really solid in every aspect of the game. Some nights our serving takes over. Some nights our offense takes over. Some nights our defense takes over. Every year, our team has the goal of qualifying for the national tournament. Once our freshmen get to experience national tournament week, it's really hard to imagine not getting to go back as sophomores. It's a really fun and exciting week of volleyball and other events. This sophomore class has worked extremely hard over the past year and have done an amazing job of leading the freshmen to where we want to be. Our freshmen jumped right on board, and we are beyond proud of each and every one of them. Sunday's victory was a roller coaster ride. The Tritons fell behind early, dominated the next two sets, then had to hold off a desperate comeback attempt by DMACC before the Bears were worn down and out in the deciding game. Former Manson Northwest Webster standout Olivia Sturgis garnered regional tournament most valuable player honors, and fellow former Cougar Emily Goodner, also a freshman, made the all-tourney team, along with Iowa Central sophomore Mercedes Matlock. "Our recruiting starts here in the area," Horn said. "We look at local players at camps, high school games, and local clubs. Both Emily and Olivia played for us at Iowa Storm Volleyball Club, and we've worked with them at camps starting 4 or 5 years ago. A huge goal of ours is giving our community players a great college athletic experience, a chance to play for one of the best junior college volleyball programs in the country, and an opportunity to compete for a national championship. Olivia and Emily are both great examples of what can happen when you work hard for your goals and continue to study and improve your game." Sturgis and Goodner are joined by former St. Edmund standout Maya McLean, high graduate Alexa Hirachetta in Iowa Central's regular rotation. Goodner recorded 20 kills in the win over the Bears, Noemia Chichaccio 19, Sturgis 11, and Emma Bilheimer 9 followed. Madlock had 56 assists. Chichaccio and McLean both tallied 24 digs, with Matlock contributing 20. In the 27-25, 24-26, 25-8, and 25-18 triumph over Kirkwood, Sturgis led the way with 11 kills. Chichaccio added 9. Matlock had 34 assists. McLean 16, Chichaccio 15, and Matlock 10 were top in digs. Chichaccio 5 aces, Hirachetta 4, Olivia Benson 3, McLean 3, and Matlock 3 were all effective at the service line. The Eagles had swept the Tritons during the regular season. Against Kirkwood, a really talented front row team, our serving took over, as we had 19 aces, Horn said. Against DMACC, our offense took over as we hit .432 and had 70 kills versus an all-sophomore back row. "We have talked all year about doing our jobs, worrying about what we can control and staying in the present. We did just that this weekend, and it paid off with winning the regional title. National pairings will be announced on Thursday. The NJCAA Division II tournament, which follows a double elimination format, is in Cedar Rapids, November 15th through the 18th. Iowa Central has placed 7th, 4th, and 3rd in the last three national tourneys. This is the Tritons' 8th NJCAA bid since 2011. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 6th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to some Mason City news. And our first Mason City headline today reads, "Change in City Building Code Approved October 17th. The Mason City Council recently amended City Code to ease the qualifications for the job of plumbing and mechanical inspector, dropping a requirement that a master plumber's license and an Iowa master HVAC license were necessary to hold the position. Under the change approved at the October 17th City Council meeting, the code now reads, "The plumbing mechanical inspector shall hold such certifications necessary to complete residential and commercial building inspections as required by Iowa code, and this code including plumbing and mechanical inspections." In a memo to the City Council, City Administrator Aaron Burnett stated, "To meet the essential requirements of the position, the CBO plumbing mechanical inspector should have certifications in residential building inspection, commercial building inspection, plumbing inspection, and mechanical inspection. These certifications are granted by the International Code Council after the inspector passes an open book exam." Councilmember Paul Adams asked if removing the language lowers the requirements to hold the position. Burnett said the requirement was being removed from city code because it's unusual for job descriptions to be codified. I think there may only be one other position in our code that does that, and I think we should change that one too, said Burnett. Perry Buffington, a city human resource director, said Iowa code doesn't require a master plumber's license. We opted for the plumbing inspector certification, he said. Burnett added that the city recently has focused on training individuals in varying city positions. The adjusted code gives the city leeway for recruitment in a position left vacant by a retirement. Asked what a hiring timeline is, Buffington said he expected to bring a candidate for the council approval by the next meeting. The council waived a second reading, and on a final reading, the change was approved unanimously. Our next local story for Mason City has a headline that reads, Orchard Woman Pleads Guilty to Stealing from Employer. An Orchard woman accused of stealing more than $21,000 from her employer has pleaded guilty in Floyd County District Court. According to court documents, 60-year-old Teresa Ann Farmer is facing up to 40 years in prison on three felony charges: ongoing criminal activity, first-degree theft, and unauthorized use of a credit card. The plea agreement calls for Farmer to plead guilty to the unauthorized use of a credit card charge in exchange for the other two charges being dismissed. The unauthorized use of a credit card charge carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. She would retain the right to ask for a deferred sentence at the sentence hearing on December 15th. The agreement also calls for Farmer to pay restitution. According to court documents, Farmer allegedly stole the money from her employer, Eggert, Erb, and Ellingson Law Firm, from 2012 until 2022 in small increments reported to be in the $300 range. The court is under no obligation to follow the plea agreement recommendation. And now turning to some statewide headlines. This one reads, Iowa governor will endorse DeSantis for president, AP sources say. The dateline is Des Moines. Governor Kim Reynolds plans to endorse Ron DeSantis for president, giving the Florida governor's 2024 campaign a boost as he struggles to show progress against Donald Trump in the Republican primary, two people familiar with the matter said Sunday. DeSantis has pinned his chances of emerging as an alternative to Trump DeSantis has pinned his chances of emerging as an alternative to Trump squarely on Iowa. Reynolds is well liked within the GOP and will break with long-standing Iowa tradition to endorse DeSantis. Iowa's governor typically stays neutral before the caucuses that kick off the Republicans' nomination calendar in January. The people familiar with the matter spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity before a Monday rally in Des Moines, where Reynolds is expected to announce her endorsement. The Des Moines Register and NBC News first reported the anticipated endorsement. Reynolds had introduced DeSantis at political events in Iowa and appeared with Florida First Lady Casey DeSantis without publicly declaring her support. But the governor often noted her shared policy priorities and accomplishments, including a bill banning abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy before many women know they are pregnant. Reynolds, who is in her second term, had left open the possibility of lending her support to a candidate in the January 15th caucuses. She had introduced Trump at an event in March, but Trump has accused her of disloyalty for weighing an endorsement before the caucuses and tried to take credit for her winning the governorship. His campaign quickly criticized her on Sunday. Kim Reynolds apparently has begun her retirement tour early, as she clearly does not have any ambition for higher office, the Trump campaign said in an emailed statement. Earlier this year, she promised her constituents that she would remain neutral in the race, yet she has completely gone back on that promise. Regardless, her endorsement will not make any difference in this race. Trump also weighed in on a series of angry social media posts, accusing her of disloyalty and reneging on her pledge to remain neutral. If and when Kim Reynolds of Iowa endorses Rhonda Sanctimonious, who is absolutely dying in the polls both in Iowa and nationwide, it will be the end of her political career, in that MAGA would never support her again, just as MAGA will never support DeSanctimonious again, he wrote. Two extremely disloyal people getting together is, however, a very beautiful thing to watch. They can now remain loyal to each other because nobody else wants them. Trump is the heavy favorite to win in Iowa. DeSantis is competing with former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley to emerge in the leadoff contest just 10 weeks away as a viable alternative to Trump. A month ago, DeSantis sent about 20 of his Tallahassee-based campaign headquarters staff to Iowa. The Super Political Action Committee supporting him, Never Back Down, has had roughly 24 staff reaching out to would-be caucus participants since the summer. On Friday, DeSantis spoke to about 50 GOP activists at an early afternoon stop in Denison, the heart of Republican-heavy Crawford County. It was the 86th Iowa county he's visited, on a mission to visit each of its 99, and the last puzzle piece in the block of conservative Western Iowa. Reynolds is popular within the party, in part for signing a school choice bill and strict abortion ban this year. And now turning to local obituaries, first we remember Elaine Huebner. Elaine Huebner of Grafton died Tuesday, October 24th at Good Samaritan Home in St. Ansgar. Memorial services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, November 7th at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Grafton. Champion's Funeral Home in Osage will handle arrangements. Visitation is today, Monday, November 6th at Emmanuel Lutheran from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Private family interment services will be held at the Grafton Cemetery at a later date. Next, we remember David Lynn Hansen. David Lynn Hansen, age 65, died Wednesday, November 1st at Osage Rehab and Health Center in Osage. A funeral service will be held at 11:30 a.m. today, Monday, November 6th, at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, located at 301 First Avenue North in Clear Lake, with Mark Doble leading the service. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will take place at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Next, we remember Kathy Hansen. Born August 21, 1947, Kathy R. Hansen, 76, formerly of Garner, passed away Monday on the 30th of October in Utah, surrounded by family. And that's all we have on Kathy. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to two letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, "Health Diagnosis Fills Wife's Head with Doubts." They write, "Dear Abby, I have recently been diagnosed with a chronic illness. I am only 40 years old, and I always took for granted that I had plenty of life left to live. I'm happily married, but I worry because my husband, Al, has become my caretaker. I feel terrible about it. My condition is very limiting. I'm in pain all the time and may have to stop working completely. I have developed depression and often cry at home. I feel so guilty as if I have ruined his life. Al swears he just wants to be with me no matter what we have to go through. I'm just not sure I can handle holding him back from the rest of his life as well. I love him so much. What should I do?" And it's signed Changed in Texas. And Abby responds, "Dear Changed, please allow me to offer my sympathy for your diagnosis. Having a painful, life-limiting health condition at such a young age would depress anyone. Please stop adding to it by burdening yourself with guilt for needing your husband's help. He loves you and has assured you he just wants to be with you no matter what. It's important that you discuss your depression and guilt with your doctor. You may need counseling, medication, and perhaps a support group to help you with the life adjustments that may lie ahead. Please gather your resolve to fight these negative emotions and reach out for the help you need. It is there, and once you do, you'll realize you have a whole team ready to help you through this. And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Old Friend is a Bad Fit for Book Club." And they write, "Dear Abby, I'm in a book club I started with friends 13 years ago. The 12 of us have grown close and value, appreciate, and respect each other. I recently invited a childhood friend to join. She's an avid reader. Abby, though she's a nice person, she simply does not fit in with the group. She talks too much, tends to brag a lot, and makes insensitive comments. An example, two of us are leaving on a cruise soon, and she shared how tacky and claustrophobic she thinks those trips are. The rest of the group were appalled, and I feel awful that I introduced her into my longtime book club. On the other hand, I cannot fathom telling my childhood friend the group would prefer she not attend. I am sure it would be hurtful. A few of us are hoping you will have a solution. Please help." And a sign reading the room. And Abby replies, "Dear Reading, how about being completely honest? Tell your childhood friend that if she wants to remain a member of the book club, she will have to brag and talk less and refrain from making insensitive comments. If she asks what you mean by that, repeat the example you shared with me. P.S. While I can understand why the two of you who are going on the cruise might have been shocked into silence, it would have been better if those two had spoken up and confronted your friend about why she would volunteer something so negative." And now turning to some local sports news. This headline reads, "High school football. West Hancock reaches state semifinals for fifth time in 6 years." And the dateline is Fairbank. Sixth-ranked West Hancock of Britt booked its third straight trip to the state semifinals and fifth in 6 years, with a 44-22 win over seventh-ranked Wapsie Valley Friday in Class A state quarterfinals. The Warriors' defense, who only gave up two-digit points once this season against Denver, had no answer to the Eagles' offensive machine, led by Mitchell Smith and Kale Zuhl, who scored on every possession but the last, where they took the knee to run down the clock. West Hancock advances to the Class A finals last year before the 27-0 loss to Grundy Center. The Eagles will play Thursday at 10 a.m. against Madrid. "I think we played very crisp offensively," West Hancock coach Mark Sanger said. "I think we controlled the line of scrimmage, and our backs did an excellent job finding the seam and getting what they could. These guys do a very good job of getting negative plays against the offense, and we didn't allow that to happen, so we kept the sticks moving." The game remained relatively competitive throughout the first half. Wapsie Valley quarterback Kanan Decker burst out after kickoff with a 39-yard run, then converted a fourth down with a 4-yard touchdown run. However, the Eagles answered back with a 35-yard pass from Smith to Zach Bukema. Zuhl finished the drive with a 3-yard dash into the end zone, then converted two for a lead they'd hold the rest of the game, 16-7. West Hancock led 24-14 at half as Decker and Zuhl each scored again. West Hancock burst the game open with a 90-yard kickoff return by Jackson Peterson to open the third quarter. The Warriors got one more scoring drive in the fourth quarter with a 24-yard pass from Decker to Ian Buzinski, but the Eagles commanded the night. West Hancock finished with 319 rushing yards, with Zuhl leading the way with 31 carries for 183 yards and 4 scores. "We knew coming in they were going to do what they do, and they do it really well. and we had to get some stops, and we just couldn't get that, said Wapsie Valley head coach Dwayne Foster. I mean, they were beating our D-line up front, and you know, they're just a very physical team, and they don't make mistakes. And hats off to Wes Hancock for playing a game where we knew exactly what they were going to do, and they just did it well. Our line did a great job that whole game, and then we're running hard, carrying guys with us those extra yards, Smith said after the game. Right away, we battled through a little adversity right there, and then just kept churning. We kept chugging. We weren't getting mad at each other. Focused, and yeah. According to Smith and Zuhl, both seniors, they're eager to reach the top of the podium again, and know they won't get another shot. They're making each practice, play, and game count in preparation for that moment. It means everything, Zuhl said. Senior year, so we want to make it count. We've had some recent success, but it's different when it's a new group coming to the senior class. Sanger backed up his player's words. It's always different when you do it your senior year. It's a whole different ball game, and that's what we've told them. As for Wapsie Valley, Foster praised his team for the grit and talent they showed throughout the year and the consistency with which they showed it. The Warriors were young going into the season, but they exceeded all expectations and brought excitement to Fairbank. Last year, we lost 16 seniors, and not many guys that were coming back had production on the field, so a lot of inexperience, and I couldn't be more proud than our guys showing up, Foster said. There wasn't a lot to be excited about at the beginning of the year. People expected us to be down, and our guys showed up every single day, and they kept fighting and getting better, and to get to the quarterfinals game. I'm very proud of our seniors for stepping up and having a very good season. And our next story reads, the headline reads, Mason City Puppy Mill among those cited by USDA. Iowa's puppy mills compiled one of the nation's worst records of compliance with animal welfare regulations in the third quarter of 2023, newly disclosed records show. For the months of July through September, the five states that compiled the highest number of animal welfare violations committed by dog breeders and kennels were Virginia with 52 violations, Wisconsin with 51, Ohio with 36 violations, Iowa with 28, and Arkansas with 17. The data, culled from the U.S. Department of Agriculture reports, was collected, analyzed, and reported by the National Animal Welfare Organization, Bailing Out Benji, which is based in Iowa. Just seven Iowa breeders were responsible for all of the violations cited in Iowa during the third quarter of the year. The number of violators and the number of violations cited fluctuates greatly depending on the number of licensed operators who are visited by inspectors. In 2022, for example, Iowa led the nation in the number of infractions cited, with 286 violations reported by the USDA over the course of the entire year. Second place Missouri had fewer than half the number of infractions, with 109 violations cited over the same period. According to the USDA reports, Iowa breeders were cited for violations in the third quarter include Carolyn Anderson of Anderson's Yorkies in Mason City. On August 3, 2023, Anderson was given an official USDA warning as a result of violations cited by inspectors more than a year ago. During a May 2022 visit, the inspectors had cited Anderson for 15 violations, including one critical violation pertaining to animal identification, record keeping, the handling of animals, housing facilities, incompatible grouping of animals, exercise for dogs, and veterinary care for dogs. When an inspector inquired about the recent death of a toy poodle named Summer, Anderson allegedly explained the puppy had died after being attacked by the other dogs. Summer may have had severe distress, trauma, and physical harm before her eventual death, the inspector reported. At that time, the inspector also noted that at least 14 adult dogs and 5 puppies were overdue for their vaccinations. The inspector returned in July 2022 and cited Anderson for 6 additional violations pertaining to the attending veterinarian, veterinary care, record keeping, animal housing facilities, and watering. The inspector reported that on June 22nd, a Yorkshire Terrier named Asher was left outside and became overheated. The dog was brought inside and cooled with wet washcloths. 2 days later, the dog was lethargic and shivering, then had a seizure and died. The inspector also noted that an indoor area where dogs are walked had brown organic material buildup covering half the floor, and dogs had to walk on the very edges of the walkway to avoid a soiled surface. The inspector found 2 adult dogs inside a wire crate with an empty dry water bowl, and there were 19 dogs and puppies that were due or overdue for their vaccinations. During a subsequent visit on August 22, 2022, USDA officials cited Anderson for 1 non-critical violation pertaining to record keeping. The inspector determined that there were 12 dogs or puppies that were counted during the last inspection and were no longer at the kennel, apparently having been sold to people Anderson couldn't identify. In 2022, Anderson was cited for a total of 38 USDA violations. The puppy mill has been previously named in the Humane Society of the United States Horrible 100 report. And then the report goes on to list additional puppy mills in Iowa that have been cited. They include Heath Myers of Century Farm Puppies in Grundy Center, Lyle Miller of Miller Clan Pugs in Wellman, Maple Grove Kennels of Iowa City, Marlon Dibbitt of Rainbow Kennels in Sioux Center, Nathan Miller of Kelowna, Scott Swanson and S&J Kennels in Ollie. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 6th, Monday, November 6th, that is. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checkers' strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.